UK Wine Show, show number 58, Viticulture with Siobhan Harnett. G'day, welcome to the UK Wine Show, show number 58 for the 6th of July 2007. My name's Chris Scott. And this week we're going to be talking with Siobhan Harnett, the viticulturist at Icon Kiwi Wine, Cloudy Bay. We're going to be talking to her about the job of being a viticulturist, spraying, frost protection, and teeth, as well as looking at when they decide to pick for their different wines, such as Cloudy Bay Sauvignon Blanc, Pelorus, and Pinot Noir. I've had a pretty tough week, so last week I've been busy running the French Wine Experience in Taste of Bath, which has been great fun but incredibly tiring, and I'm just about to head off and do the Taste of Birmingham. So if you're going to the Taste of Birmingham, do come and see me. I'll be quite pleased to talk to people about what they like about the show and what they don't. Always good to get some feedback as well. Next up is the news with Jane Scott.
Thanks, Chris. In the news this week, Camel Valley scoops a top trophy and how Tesco has plans for En Primeur. But first, it's not just the UK having freak weather this summer. Over in France, hailstorms in Alsace and Côte-Rôti have caused damage to vineyards. Between 800 and 1,000 hectares suffered damage in Alsace, and in Côte-Rôti in the Rhône, it looks as though 25 to 30% of vines may have been lost. The hail hit 2 weeks ago, and although significant, the damage is not as severe as first expected. Thankfully, here in England, vineyards have been largely unaffected by the floods and torrential rain we've been having over the last couple of weeks. Next up, news that Tesco may offer its customers Bordeaux wines en primeur. The wines would be paid for by customers 2 years before they are released, and would be marketed through the supermarket's wine club starting from the 2007 campaign if it's suitable. Waitrose already sells Bordeaux this way in conjunction with Leigh & Wheeler, and while volumes aren't that big, they say they definitely have a market for it that they will develop, provided it continues to make commercial sense. And finally this week, good news for Cornish winery Camel Valley. They've just scooped the top prize in the English and Welsh Wine of the Year competition with their Pinot Noir Rosé 2004. Camel Valley's Sam Lindo was also named UK Winemaker of the Year, and the vineyard won Best Sparkling Wine. Judges of the competition agreed unanimously that the main stars of the show were rosés, both the still and sparkling variety, as well as sparkling whites. They believe sparkling rosé is an up-and-coming style that works well in England. Well, that's all for this week, but 10 years ago, in 1997, Cloudy Bay was Wine of the Month in GQ magazine. The 1996 vintage was £12 a bottle, and wine columnist John Graham describes aromas of peaches, lychees, and green Adillos. I get the first two, but if anyone has ever tasted a green Adillo, we'd love to hear from you. As far as we know, it's a type of passion fruit. Don't forget, you can check out the news in full on the news homepage at our website, www.3050.co.uk. That's all for me this week. Back over to you, Chris.
Cheers for that, Jane. Well, the Bordeaux En Primeur market is in full swing. If you're not sure what En Primeur is, it's the Bordeaux producers selling their wine before they've even put it into a bottle. You buy it, you pay for it, and then they'll deliver it to you a couple of years later. But Cheval Blanc, a first growth, has released its 2006 pricing, the same as last year, which is a bit surprising given that most people thought the 2005 vintage, which was released last year, was the best in a long, long time, and 2006 vintage, which is on sale now, wasn't considered anywhere near as good. So, interesting they kept their prices up. There was a lot of talk in the UK and American press about trying to keep prices down for 2006 because the quality wasn't as good. But I think this argument's pretty pointless. Top Chateau's prices has little to do with the quality of the wine that they're selling and more about supply and demand. With the emergence of China and India into the market, the Chateaus are hoping that this will soak up any downturn from the UK and US market. I personally think that the release price of a lot of these wines has less to do with the quality of the wine and more to do with world economics. It's similar to art in that prices will rise and fall based on fashion and wealth. There are a number of good questions that this raises, though. Is it wrong for this to happen? Could instabilities in price create problems for the market? But As anybody in business knows, the objective is to maximise profit. And if you sell out at a price, the price can't be too high. Maybe the UK and US are getting a bit worried because there's been a shift to Indian and Chinese markets. But I'm more concerned with those a bit further down the food pecking order, rather than the top 30 to 100 chateaus that get all the talk. There are so many small producers in Bordeaux. After all, Bordeaux produces more wine than Australia does, yet they hardly get a look in. Funnily enough, from my point of view, for a socialist economy such as France, that you're getting more of the have wineries and than the have-nots, with a lot of wineries getting into all sorts of problems, particularly in the Languedoc, where the militant craft, almost terrorist group, have been blowing up supermarkets and threatening the new president because they just can't sell their product. Well, the super chateaus are being able to charge extraordinary prices for their wine. Next up is the interview with Siobhan Harnett, viticulturist at Cloudy Bay. Hi, I'm here with Siobhan Harnett. She's the viticulturist at Cloudy Bay. How are you?
I'm well, thanks.
Excellent. We're going to be talking in the show just about viticulture and what exactly a viticulturist does. What do you do?
Essentially, I make sure that the right volumes of the right varieties in the right style are delivered in time to the winery.
So what does that mean? Does that mean that you're out picking grapes, or are you choosing what grapes go get planted where?
It can start from site selection and sourcing. For Cloudy Bay, half of our vineyards are estate grown, so they're our own variety, vineyards, and the other half are with our contract growers. We have 7 contract growers. So it's liaising with our growers and cruising around managing the vineyard managers and talking and discussing with the winemakers.
The winemakers get all the glory. You know, they are the pretty boys of the wine industry, really. Do you feel like you play second fiddle to them at Cloudy Bay?
No, not for a minute, really. They're a pretty good bunch. You're quite right. I think it's the perception of the industry, and the winemakers are so often in the market and often are articulate and the primary sort of ambassadors for a lot of wineries. But I think a lot of all good winemakers know that they have to have the fruit behind them, and whether it's a vineyard manager or a viticulturist that they have, that is essential to quality wine production.
What sort of training have you had, Siobhan?
I've got a degree in agricultural science, and then I went on and did a master's specifically in viticulture, and I worked as a viticulturist for a while, and then for me I was probably a little different. I stopped and did an MBA, and then I went back to viticulture. So I've taken the very long way around it.
Yeah, MBA back to viticulture.
Exactly.
Do you like being outside?
I do, very much. Just on the warm, sunny days.
What's the worst thing about the job?
Well, I can't really think about what's cellar the worst work, thing about my job. Oh, yeah. Well, I don't have to do cellar work. I think early on in my training, when you're working around all departments, I did work in the cellar for a little bit and knew instantly that I just wanted to get back outside because it was kind of damp and cool, and you were incredibly responsible for all this fruit that you knew someone had spent their year growing. So, yeah, I was keen to get back out into the vineyard.
What are the main sort of elements of the year from a viticulturalist point of view?
We start our pruning generally in the beginning of June, and that can go through until early September, sometimes mid-September. And then there is spring activities, a lot of mowing. We start spraying, and we start wire lifting in November. We continue that through to December and start trimming our canopies.
What's wire lifting?
Well, we have these two sets on either side of the canopy that are movable wires that essentially chase all the shoot growth up the post, and they sit there and support the summer's growth so that you end up with a very tall, thin canopy from row to row. If you look across the vineyard in Marlborough, you know, the vineyards should look like a series of radiator fins, thin, open, and well ventilated. That's what you're aiming for.
Yep.
It's quite a manipulated canopy.
Okay, so you do your pruning, your wire lifting, and then
Later on, from around December is the month of flowering for us with our Sauvignon. We will leaf pluck, mechanically leaf pluck often, which is removing the leaves around the bunch zone. And we will often, depending on the kind of season we have, we'll repeat that. We'll repeat the trimming and leaf plucking through until harvest, which for for us is mostly we pick our Sauvignon in the month of April.
Do you do a lot of spraying?
Not a great deal. Probably once every 2 weeks. Definitely a sulphur regime to manage us powdery mildew. We have key times of the season when we manage botrytis, and botrytis is probably the disease that could potentially harm us the most. It's a disease of warm, wet conditions, and although botrytis mold is something that we certainly want in our late harvest Riesling, we can't tolerate it in our other varieties. The mold itself produces an enzyme called lacase, and lacase in your wine will mean that the wine will lose its fruitiness, it will lose its stability and soundness, it will prematurely age in the bottle, and it's generally not very charming.
Oh, okay. So, but in sweet wines, it's quite a good thing. So,
yeah, it is.
Botrytis wines are known to age very well.
I know.
So.
Don't ask me to explain it. I'll have to hit one of the winemakers up at work about why that is. Another thing about botrytis wines is they're often quite high in residual sugar, or they can be quite wine, and that's a bit of a preservative also. So maybe that's an idea, but it's a good question that I should go back and ask before I hit the road internationally. Make a boob of myself on the radio.
Exactly. What about picking? What are the key drivers maybe for picking, say, Sauvignon Blanc?
Sav for us is really interesting because the fruit just before harvest tastes exactly on the vine as it will do once the wine is finished fermenting. It's really transparent and it's quite exciting. So prior to harvest, you're driving around looking at all the blocks and tasting berries on the vine. We take a little field sample, which is about a half kilo bag, and take that back to the lab for analysis. We look at percentage sugar and titratable acidity and pH, really standard parameters for many wine regions. But we also eat a lot of fruit, which means we don't have a big dinner at the end of the night. And you're perennially full. And we keep a note on the flavour spectrum that the fruit's at. And that's, for the Sauvignon, that's a big driver in the decision-making process of when to pick. We also look at how clean and healthy the block is and keep a really strong eye on the weather map, because in our climate it's cool and we do have about 50 mils of rain a month every month. So we're sort of typically during harvest, we're often ducking and diving through natural rain events.
So Cloudy Bay is quite known for Sauvignon Blanc. We also do a sparkling Pelorus. What are you choosing? What are you picking on then?
Well, our non-vintage Pelorus is predominantly Chardonnay, and then our vintage Pelorus is predominantly Pinot Noir. We don't have any Pinot Meunier. In fact, there's not a lot of Meunier in Marlborough. I don't know why. I think it was a lot to do with the clonal selections that made it out to New Zealand and how they performed in our climate. It's quite a different brief for growing sparkling base, because when it goes into the winery, it takes a lot of time, and there are a lot of different winemaking processes that go on. Essentially, our role in the vineyard is to give the winery a lovely blank base wine canvas. So we're looking for high fresh acid, sugars that aren't too ripe, because of course it has to go then through the secondary ferment, which can, push
increase
the alcohol,
yeah,
and increase your potential alcohol there. So, but not a lot of flavor development. We don't want overtly fruity base wine. We want a nice blank, tight canvas built to last. That's delivered, and it has to be very clean and very sound.
What about Pinot Noir for still wine?
That's quite different. Pinot Noir is really sensitive. It's a little like cooking an egg. For a while it can be underdone, and then you turn your back and it's rubbery and overdone. So it has a very small window of opportunity. You have to be very vigilant. A lot of it, we don't want our sugars to race away on us. We don't want sort of an alcohol rage going on. You have to keep a very close eye on the flavours, and they're very subtle in the berry.
Do you get flavours that land up in the wine, or are you picking on different flavours?
The Pinot Noir is a kind of interesting combination in the field. There is the flavour in the fruit, but there's also the condition and the flavours and the tannins and the skins and pips. That's equally as important. So, you'll often be eating the Pinot Noir berries and then opening them up in your fingers, and you'll be checking that the little pip has actually gone completely brown and lignified, and there's a sort of a gelatinous coating, a lot like a tomato seed on a Pinot Noir berry. And as it gets riper, that gelatinous coating, it's not gelatinous really, it's, I don't know what it is, it's kind of slippery and slimy, but that will degrade, and that gives you a good indication that things are moving along. And then when you rub your thumbnail across the skin, it should start to express all the lovely, you know, rich red colour. So you know, well, you're not far away now, and you can build up a short list and start, you know, knocking on the winemakers' doors to come out and have a look, so that we can all be in agreement when we harvest the blocks.
I noticed you said you ate a lot of grapes, which are full of acids, but I also noticed you've actually got nice teeth.
I've got my own teeth.
Yeah, and your own teeth as well. I was going to ask whether
they're yours. Sound and wind and limb.
Yeah, exactly. You look around, we're recording this London National Wine Show, and everybody looks like Austin Powers.
Or Wurzel Gummidge.
Worst teeth in the world. What's the story there?
Well, everyone looks rough after they've been tasting red wine, especially. And there are lots of international producers here today that have very big, you know, tannic, inky reds, so there are a few sort of victims floating around here today. For myself, and I know a lot of people in the wine industry in Marlborough, you can actually get particularly the upper inside of your molars and the back of the rear of your front teeth, you can get them lacquered with a kind of an enamel protectant. Particularly when you're wine tasting and you're sort of sucking wine up and it's rushing past your back teeth, your upper molars, you can have it's kind of temporary. It lasts about 9 or 10 months, but it protects the enamel, because if you're constantly eating high acid fruit or drinking high acid beverages like wine, you'll actually start, it's like sandblasting, that enamel gets very soft and it can degrade, and you can end up with very sensitive teeth as well.
Okay, well, I don't want to go too long. I just noticed your teeth were all right for a change.
It's a bit dodgy.
Exactly. You know, why? Siobhan, you've got lovely teeth.
Yes, well.
Okay. We touched on spraying in the vineyard. Mm-hmm. We were talking earlier, and you mentioned you're doing a new program on your type of pesticide control.
Okay. In our climate, we don't actually apply a lot of insecticides. We don't have a lot of insect pests. We have a very cold winter, which is pretty hard on an insect. And we're not a terribly hot season, and because they're little cold-blooded creatures, they require a lot of heat to get their populations going seriously. So one pest that we do have is a little caterpillar called a leaf roller, which grows into a light brown apple moth. And they're not a problem, but they create a mess of dead tissue, and botrytis likes to live on dead tissue. So we will keep an eye on those levels. If they spike, we can spray and manage the spike in populations, but we have a range of nicer, newer compounds now that are available to us, and one of them is called an MAC, or a malt accelerating compound. So they're targeted at, they're sprayed onto the leaf and the caterpillar eats the leaf. He goes into an early and continuous malt cycle, and then he doesn't survive.
See, malt accelerating compound sounds like something you'd have in a brewery.
I'm sure you had a malt accelerating compound on Friday night.
Excellent. Okay, last thing I wanted to just touch on was frost management. We've heard some interesting ways of managing frost in the UK. What do they use in New Zealand?
We use a lot of wind machines, yep, which are like big windmills on stands, and they act fairly similar, in the same action of like a ceiling fan. And the idea is that they rotate 360 degrees, and they actually draw the warmer air above, sort of 20 to 30 metres above the ground, and they draw it down onto ground level, because when a frost occurs, the earth's surface cools, from the surface upward. So it sort of mixes all the warm air down and hopefully raises the ambient temperature, and you can avoid tissue damage.
Okay, and is that the main method, or is there other?
We also have helicopters, yep, which, the way they operate is the same as the static wind machine.
Yeah.
But, of course, they're movable. Yep. So sometimes in our forecasts, we'll see one side of the valley is more vulnerable to frost than the other, so we can relocate them, which is really good.
Yeah, and they just hover above the ground for a while?
They do. They sort of, they hover around. They go upwind. There will be a prevailing night breeze, so you get them to go upwind and then zigzag their way back down to you and then zoom upwind again. So they do have a rough pattern.
Okay.
So we can try and keep control of them. Make sure they're not buzzing over the neighbour's block.
Exactly. It's just wasted money, isn't it?
It's very neighbourly.
Yeah. Okay, I think we'll wrap it up there, Siobhan. Thank you very much.
No worries.
Cheers.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with Siobhan. I thought she did a great job getting across what she does and where she adds value in the winemaking process. I have a second interview with Siobhan talking a bit more about canopy management and what it means to the wine. Next week, we're going to be talking with Tim Howe, the CEO of Majestic Wines. Majestic are probably the most successful wine merchant in the UK at the moment and compete head-on with supermarkets very effectively. We're going to be talking to him about why they've had another year of record profits at 14% growth on last year. And we talked to Tim about why Majestic is growing so well as the rest of the high street specialists wither against the onslaught of the supermarkets. So, until next week, cheers and good drinking.
The UK Wine Show is a weekly podcast brought to you by 3050, the wine tasting company. The show is produced by Jane Scott, recorded and edited by Chris Scott, and the news is researched by Sandra Clement. To listen to other shows, visit www.ukwineshow.co.uk. Thank you for listening.